Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Hour 2 is now underway. So glad you're with me this morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Friday, May 25 already. If you're starting to talk to someone and they start blinking a lot, do you know that that might mean that they've stopped paying attention? So I sit here in the radio studio going, are you blinking right now? Are you blinking? Blinking is much like closing your eyes. It puts up a barrier against basically the outside world, and it allows your brain to focus on something else. So studies have shown that when a person starts to blink more rapidly, it would suggest their mind is wandering. So keep that in mind today as you go about your biz. So anyway, Friday, this is the start of a nice long holiday weekend, and Rebecca Maxwell, our producer here, and she is starting a very exciting adventure starting this weekend.
I am, yes.
Yes, and you're going to be going to Des Moines today and then not returning till after your honeymoon.
That is true. Also, there's 2-for-1 tickets at Adventureland theme park, so
sweet.
That's pretty exciting.
Sweet.
I'm sorry. That's my attempt at jokes, and I won't do it anymore.
I love them. So you guys doing standard vows, or did you write your own? Or
We're going to go with the classics
because we felt
like we couldn't really improve on that. Yeah. And then you forget it, and you mess up the script, and then you're red-faced in front of all your family and friends. And
yeah.
No, we're going to go with the classic pledge, the classic covenant.
Yeah.
We do have a couple of cool things that we're going to do. My fiance has children, so we're going to incorporate them in the unity ceremony.
Nice. So you guys doing the unity candle?
No.
Okay. Is that, they still do that?
Yeah. A lot of people do, and it's a beloved part of the ceremony. Mm-hmm. But I thought, I've seen enough of those things where they don't light and it's outside, and I thought, oh no, there's no worse way to start it than when the unity candle just won't light.
Right, right.
And you're standing there for 5 minutes.
So do you have your scripture passages already for the wedding?
Yes, I believe so.
Can you share one?
Well, I mean, the one that has really become the verse for us is, we love because he first loved us.
Uh-huh.
And which is 1 John 4. And the concept that the way that we're capable of loving one another is entirely dependent on our relationship with God. The only way that we will be strong enough to love one another when we are unlovable, because we'll both have those moments. We have had and will have those moments where neither one of us is particularly lovable. But the love that we have transcends that in so far as it is secure in Christ. And we know that God loved us when we weren't very lovable either.
Yeah.
And so drawing from that is, I think, the only place that we can have that bedrock for a lifelong commitment like that.
Beautifully said. And I want
our listeners to
know I didn't blink once when she was talking.
And I didn't count either, but
I will. I didn't blink.
I'm going to start counting.
Let's take a little break. When we come back, Welby O'Brien, I had a chance to talk to her just a few days ago about PTSD. She has a husband who's a 100% disabled veteran. But boy, does she love and want to share her wisdom and knowledge with people suffering from PTSD. Be back in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I love the topic of our next guest and the way in which she's gone about dealing with it. Welby O'Brien, which, by the way, is a fun name to say, has written a book called Love Our Vets, Restoring Hope for Families of Veterans with PTSD. And 100% of the author's proceeds goes to helping vets and their families. So she is the real deal. Good morning, Welby.
Good morning, Bill.
Now, you've got a background in counseling, is that right?
That's right.
And
I have a master's degree in counseling.
Awesome. And you also happen to live with a husband who is a disabled veteran.
Yes, he is a Vietnam veteran, and he has been rated 100% disability by the VA, and his primary struggle is with post-traumatic stress.
Yeah. And that is such a big subject and such a big topic, and most of us feel very inadequate talking about it or understanding it. So hopefully you can help us this morning.
Okay. Happy to do so.
So let's kind of start at the beginning, kind of what is it and what causes it?
Okay. Actually, post-traumatic stress can happen to anyone, not just veterans. And it is a result of exposure to an experience that's horrific or life-threatening. And what actually happens is the whole person gets locked into emergency survival mode. You've heard of fight, flight, or freeze.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's what happens. And they stay permanently locked in that survival mode 24/7 for the rest of their lives at some level. So when something triggers them back to that trauma, they don't have any reserve with which to handle it, and that makes it really hard for them to cope with stress and things that come up. The good news is that there is help and hope, and they can learn to thrive again.
Mm-hmm. So, Welby, if you're in that fight-or-flight response, I know your body's going completely haywire, and the adrenaline is pumping, and chemicals are being dumped into your body. Is that a little bit of the condition that a person is sort of in all the time? I'm trying to understand what they're experiencing physiologically.
And that's a good question, because it is definitely not all in their head. It's a very physiological response, and that's the crazy thing, is it has been kind of reprogrammed, rewired. It's in the brain, it's in the adrenals. For many of them, the adrenals never stop, and sleep is just like very rare. And that, of course, as we all know, just starts a whole cascade of other things going on. So for some, it's ongoing, more intense than others, and others, it's more just when something will come along to trigger them back, and that could be a sight or a smell or something on the TV or a sound, anything that reminds them of the trauma and just turns that switch back on.
Mm-hmm. So my next question might be, if I have a loved one in my world and I don't know if they have it or not, how would I start investigating that as an option? And maybe what are some of the symptoms this person might have which would say, I need to look into this more deeply?
Yeah, good question. Some of the typical symptoms, and the good news is not everybody has all of these, but some things to kind of look for would be anxiety, fear, depression, hypervigilance, being easily startled, numbing, nightmares, flashbacks, substance abuse or other addictive behaviors, sleep problems, employment problems, relationship problems, putting up walls and withdrawing, and unfortunately, sometimes suicidal thoughts.
Okay.
So they're basically people who are responding normally to an abnormal event. And if you see some of those signs or you suspect it in yourself or your loved one, look into it. And I would encourage you to start at our website, which is loveourvets.org. We've got just a ton of information, a ton of resources, not only for the PTSD survivor, but for the loved ones as well.
Mm-hmm. So, Welby, if I think of your husband, who is a 100% disabled veteran with PTSD, when I think of him being in the war and possibly witnessing some fellow soldier he knew and loved and cared for die before his very eyes, the question would be, when is he supposed to get over that? To which my answer is never, but he's got to figure out a way to manage the pain. Is that correct?
Right, and that's really well put, Bill. They do not get over it. You can't get over a tragic loss of any kind, whether it's combat-related or it's somebody who's lost a loved one in a car accident or a sudden death or any kind of abuse going on and so on. You can't get over it, and sometimes people say the most careless things like that. It's all in the past, suck it up,
right,
and so on. And I want to just inject here, too, that we have a little card called PTSD Basics, and we give those out for free and by the hundreds to anybody who wants them. It just says what PTSD is, what it isn't, what not to say, and the things you can do that are helpful. It's just kind of a nice summary, so you can have contact us for some of those. But as far as can you get over it, not 100%, because that trauma and its indelible impact is going to be there forever. But the good news is there are more resources and therapies available today than ever before in all of history. And one thing might work for one person but not for another, so it's really good to research what the options are, connect with people who are going through it or who are involved, and find out what's there, because it can be helped. And that's what our whole message is, not just the book Love Our Vets, but the support network and the resources that we've got. There is help and there is hope, and they will not 100% get over it, at least at this point in time. We know of no magic formula, but they definitely can learn to thrive again. And I live with that. I see it every day, and I see how far my husband's come over the years. And sure, there will always be triggers, and there will always be hard times, but the good times are there too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm real curious as to how we have conversation with people that go through experiences. I mean, I was in a car accident a couple of years ago, and I got T-boned, and my car was entirely totaled. Fortunately, all my airbags went off and all that. But that sound of crushing metal, where you're literally your car becomes this cavern of like white powder because your airbags have gone off and you can't see anything and all you're hearing is crunching metal and you just don't know what the end result's going to be. Fortunately, I wasn't hurt, and the other driver wasn't hurt, but there was that sense of driving around for the next year kind of feeling a little bit sheepish. Was I experiencing a little post-traumatic stress syndrome there?
Absolutely. When you say sheepish, I would call that hypervigilance.
Okay,
you had your guard up, you were looking around, you were braced for that to happen again. And that's definitely, just imagine if you had lost someone you loved dearly in that accident, how that would be affecting you, multiply that, how that would feel.
Mm-hmm.
If you had to go through that grief every time you felt that reminder. So that is definitely a good example.
Yeah, but do we bring this up in conversation? If a friend of mine went through what I went through, would it be, would I say something like, you know, there could be some PTSD down the road for you. You're going to want to address that and figure out a way to manage that.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly the best way to word it, but
right.
I think the most important thing is to communicate and to care and to let people know that there's hope. And if you can just, you know, like the connecting point.
Right.
Where can you and that person connect and start from there? You know, I've been through a really bad accident, and here's what happened to me, and here's what I've learned, and I encourage you to, or let's look at this website together, and let's, you know, do you have somebody that can help you look into this? So definitely... lovingly encourage people with not this doom and gloom thing, but that there is help and hope, and that they're not crazy. It's not their fault. It's something that happens, and they're actually to be applauded, as we say, with PTSD, every day is a victory.
Right.
And people don't realize what it takes for some people to just get through the day.
Yeah. Let me take a break here, Welby. I'm talking to Welby O'Brien. She's written a book called Love Our Vets, Restoring Hope for Families of Veterans with PTSD. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I'm so glad you're listening today, and I'm having a great conversation with Welby O'Brien. She's written a book called Love Our Vets, Restoring Hope for Families of Veterans with PTSD. And we also have this discussion going that you don't necessarily have to be a vet to have PTSD, and it's something that is a very serious issue. And some of the points she brings up in her book might suggest you have a little of it yourself, which is always good to keep in mind. People who suffer, they stay quiet from their experience because they basically think that no one's going to understand what they're going through. How do we build a bridge to those people that might be getting isolated from us because of their PTSD and they don't want to get vulnerable?
Yeah, that's a good question, too. One of the things I have on the website, and I encourage people to look at, it's one of my blogs. It's called 10 Things That People with PTSD and Their Loved Ones Need From, and I titled it Church People and Ministry Leaders, but it actually applies to everyone, too. What do the people with PTSD and their loved ones need? And it's a challenge because anybody we know who's going through any crisis of any time, we feel, if you're like me, you feel like, I don't know what to say, so I'm not going to say anything or do anything because we're afraid we might do it wrong. And I would just say, ask the Lord to show you how to connect with that person. And mostly it's a sense of caring, and how you do it is probably not all that important, the right or wrong way to do it. But again, look at the PTSD basics, the things to not say, the things to say, but basically being there and supporting them and not feeling the need to fix or change them. If they want to be quiet or they need to be alone, let them know that that's totally okay and you're there for them if and when they want to talk, and send them an email with some resources they can look into if they want, and respect that, but just let them know you're there if and when they're ready to have that connection.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your book, Love Our Vets, you divided it into three parts: reaffirm, replenish, and reflect. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'm not into writing the kind of books where you have to read it from cover to cover just because I'm ADD and I can't do that myself.
Mm-hmm.
So this one is set up as sort of a go-to book, as a resource. The first section is a collection of over 60 questions that are particularly unique to the loved ones of those with PTSD, and you can kind of flip through there and relate with the one that you may need at that point in time, and questions and answers from my experience and along with all those that I work with and connect with and have learned from myself. The second section is replenish, and it's all about self-care and our needs. And too many of us are just give, and then we burn out, and nobody wins from that. So it's a checklist and a reminder of things that we need to do to take care of ourselves as we minister to those around us. And then the third section is a collection of testimonies and just sayings and little snippets and things that other people who live in the world of PTSD have learned and are sharing, and it's just kind of a treasure chest, a gold mine. So there's lots in there, and it's just a resource for people to go to when they need it and find what they need for encouragement and practical help.
Mm-hmm. Now, you and your husband are both believers, is that correct?
Absolutely.
Awesome. And I love that there is something known as PTSD. I know there's kind of a stigma attached to it, and that's improving, isn't it?
It is, slowly, and it'll probably always be there at some level, but thankfully people are becoming well aware of it and are realizing this is a reality that can happen to anyone.
Mm-hmm. Because we all certainly go through trauma and brokenness and sadness and events in our lives that kind of rattle us right down to the bone. So as Christians, how do we process that through spiritual disciplines as well?
Well, it's important to realize that just because you're a Christian doesn't mean that everything's going to be hunky-dory. And as we know, God never promised to shield us from the hard times.
Right.
He never promised to take away trauma, but he did promise to be with us in the hard times, to guide us through, to use the things that we don't like in our lives. He can use those for good, even though we may not see that at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And as believers, we have those promises and we have the perspective and we can pray. I honestly don't know how people do it who don't have the Lord. Maybe that's why there's so much substance abuse for PTSD survivors.
Mm-hmm.
But it's such a privilege to be able to cling to those promises and to pray together in the hard times and in the good times too. And to remember that Jesus knew all about trauma. And when you have been traumatized, one of the worst things is that you feel alone. And so just knowing that you're not alone, that you've always got the Lord there, even when there may not be people around you. So there's help and there's hope. And as I say in the book, faith and love are the key. The faith connects us to God, and the love connects us to the support of those around us.
Mm-hmm. I have a question about the PTSD. I know I want to be so sensitive to this question, and I know you, your husband has it and all that, and many, many veterans have it. And I'm wondering if some people can flourish and thrive after PTSD, and some people can stay and use it as a reason to be left alone. I don't know if I said that well.
It was perfect.
Okay, good.
PTSD, as any thing, can be used as an excuse for misbehavior, for mistreating people around you. I'm not so sure that just kind of isolating every now and then and getting alone is such a bad thing for some. It's their survival. But you're right, everybody responds differently, and the people who actually are thriving, in my experience, are those who have taken the hard step of reaching out and connecting and getting that support. And even at whatever level is comfortable for them, that they can do. So we do very much encourage that connection with others, reaching out to see what's there, even if it's hard, try not to isolate, but that, yeah, the PTSD is going to always be there, whether you're a veteran or someone who has gotten the trauma from someplace else. But just mm-hmm. know that there is hope and you can thrive. It's never going to go away, but it can get better. And I just want people to know there is that hope.
I love that you've been using that word many times this morning, Welby, is the word hope. And the best place to go find out more information about your book is loveourvets.org. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And you've given us a lot to chew on and a lot of hope, which is one of the very things I was hoping would happen from this interview. And you did it beautifully, Welby. And my blessing to you and your husband who suffers from it. And thank you for writing this book and sharing your faith and your life with our listeners. And I just appreciate you very much.
Well, thank you. And thanks for taking the time to help put the word out.
You bet, Welby. Have a great, great day.
Okay, you too, Bill.
Thanks. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute.
The mark of a good parent is not necessarily a good kid who never gets into trouble, makes a bad decision, or fails a class. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. The mark of good parenting is not only determined by the way a child acts at home during their teen years, but also how a child engages and responds during their adult years. You see, this is a marathon, not a 50-yard dash. Your teen may make some embarrassing mistakes, but when you move toward them in love, you'll sow the seeds for a healthy relationship that endures for years. Hey, wouldn't you want a well-balanced adult child who messed up in their teens rather than a perfect kid who fell apart in their 30s? Remember, this is a marathon, not a sprint.
There's helpful new parenting resources from Mark Gregston coming soon to ParentingTodaysTeens.org.
It is 20 minutes until the top of the hour. Chris Martin, regular contributor to the show, is a millennial evangelical. He works as an author development specialist at Lifeway Christian Resources. He has his MDiv from Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, and he's a gigantic Chicago Cubs fan. Hello, Chris.
Hey, how you doing this morning?
I'm good. Let's talk about millennials and trust. It seems like boomers would say we have to reject authority, but now as they've gotten older, they said you can't question authority. So we've come full circle. As far as millennials, they have a issue with trust, don't they?
Yeah, they do. You're right. It has kind of come full circle, and we have every reason to believe that maybe millennials will, even though they may distrust authority or distrust institutions today, that once they get older, closer to the age of boomers now, they may come to do just the same and kind of come full circle. But a while back, I was reading a book called Teams That Thrive by Ryan Hartwig and Warren Bird. It's like a church leadership book. And talking about how church leaders can build trust in their churches. And they had three basic ways church leaders could build trust in their churches that they were writing in more of a general sense, but I thought could be applied to millennials specifically. And so the three ways are being competent, being honest and transparent, and being reliable. So how does being competent help you build trust with millennials? Well, I mean, just like it helps you build trust with anyone. It's hard for followers to follow a leader, whether it be congregants following a pastor or people on staff following a pastor. It's hard to follow someone who displays on a consistent basis that they lack the competency to lead. And so I think one of the things that pastors, church leaders, parents, you know, whoever is trying to lead millennials should consider is that young people are watching whether or not you're doing what you should be. And so competency, character are both really important. Being honest and transparent, I've written about this a lot, both on the blog and in my new book, about how millennials don't trust institutions. That's no secret. Mm-hmm. Millennials grew up in the age of the collapse of Enron, the housing crisis, September 11th, and resulting conflicts in the Middle East. The Catholic sex scandal and more recent evangelical scandals, young people don't trust institutions largely. And so being honest and transparent is really important to help combat that. A while back, I was in Chicago and did the architecture tour. It's like a boat tour on the river there in Chicago. Mm-hmm. I highly recommend anyone who goes there to do it. But one of the things that the architecture tour guide was saying is that in bank architecture, it used to be common and kind of trendy for banks to build huge, like stone, palatial looking structures. You know, you can have this sort of like old school New York Federal Building bank kind of feel. But then after the Great Depression, as banks considered their architecture, you know, a lot of people lost trust in banks, obviously, after the Great Depression. Bank architecture shifted to having more glass, less stone, so that people could see in, you know, feel like they're seeing into banks and feel like they were being more transparent. It's kind of a mind trick with architecture, and it's fascinating. And I think there are ways that, you know, I'm not saying churches need to build glass churches or anything like that, but I think there are ways that churches can communicate honesty and transparency. Now, obviously, churches don't need to be, and church leaders don't need to be airing all of their dirty laundry about every little crisis that happens in the church. I mean, there are some things that, you know, counseling situations or whatever that need to be handled on a one-on-one basis. But I think, you know, if there are decisions the church is making or, you know, big moves, things that congregants ought to be let in on, young people especially, the more transparent a church can be, the better in many ways. And then third, being reliable. Now, obviously, in some ways, this one goes hand in hand with just being competent. It's hard to be reliable if you're not competent. But But a question a lot of young people are asking of their leaders is, can you be trusted to do what you'll say you'll do? Do you follow through on what you say, on the promises that you make? If you say you're going to show up to an event, do you show up late or not at all, or do you come? So I think it's important for church leaders or pastors or parents to consider these three things: their competency and character, I would kind of put alongside that, their honesty and transparency, and how reliable they are. Mm-hmm. I think those are three kind of simple ways that people leading millennials in any capacity can consider when they're trying to build trust with them.
Mm-hmm. Chris, I was talking about some great old graduation speeches, and one of them was Charlie Munger's speech, kind of piggybacking off what Johnny Carson was saying about a prescription for misery in life. And one of Munger's first prescriptions for misery is be unreliable. Do not faithfully do what you have engaged to do, and you will have a life of misery. So, yeah, all these are really good things that you're discussing, and I can see how they resonate with millennials. They resonate with me. They recognize competence and incompetence, so that's going to affect their trust. Being transparent and honest, I think of my bank that I have gone to for 40, 35 years in my neighborhood. They just bought the old Dairy Queen, and they moved. So they now have a wall of windows. And I went in there and I talked to the manager and I said, well, how are you liking this? And she said, I just love it. Look at the light pouring in. Look at all the windows. I go, yeah, you're making your point. They're trying to build trust, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, there are all kinds of ways that churches can do this. I think, unfortunately, a lot of churches today, part of the reason I started helping pastors and church leaders try to reach millennials in the first place is a lot of churches or Christian organizations have been told, if you want to reach young people, you need to change your message or you need to change what you believe, because young people have different beliefs than older people. And so if you want to reach young people, you need to compromise on what you believe. And I don't think that's the case. You may reach some millennials doing that, but I don't think that's an effective way to do it. I think you lose the whole purpose of what you're trying to reach millennials to if you compromise on your convictions and what you believe. So I think there are little ways that churches, Christian organizations, can relate to millennials, can change their own actions, how transparent they are, how secretive they are, how they make mm-hmm. their decisions, how open they are about how they make their decisions. Little things that aren't changing convictions or beliefs or core values or biblical principles that help build trust with young people.
Chris, let me take a little break, and then when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Chris Martin. It's 12 minutes till the top of the hour. We'll be right back. Minutes till the top of the hour. Chris Martin is my guest. You can go to millennialevangelical.com to read his good stuff. Chris, it seems like we should be looking for ways to invest and speak truth into the lives of millennials, because so few of them are considering themselves spiritual and religious. So few are starting to attend church. They're in trouble, aren't they?
Yeah, it's really interesting. There's some data that's a couple years old now, I think, from the Pew Research Center, but it's still relevant. I doubt it's changed much. If anything, the point that it makes has been reinforced in the last couple of years. I wrote in the post that I wrote about this that millennials' lack of faith is disturbing, which is kind of a co-op of a Star Wars line, which is appropriate for this weekend, I guess. But
it is.
There's a lot of data that shows how millennials aren't as spiritual in general, not just Christian mm-hmm. or anything like that, just not as spiritual in general or as religious, I suppose, in general as generations that came before them. So just a couple of stats to kind of set this up. I'm going to use a couple of terms, older millennials and younger millennials. Older millennials are those born in the 80s. Younger are those born in the 90s. So 27% of millennials born in the 80s attend religious services every week, while 38% of boomers do. So a significantly less portion of older millennials. 36% of younger millennials seldom or never pray, where 22% of Gen Xers seldom or never pray. So younger millennials aren't praying nearly at the rate that generations older than them are. 33% of younger millennials find religion to be not too important or important at all. Only 5% find it very important. And so it's really interesting to see how millennials think about religion, because they do seem to care about more broadly spiritual things, right? Religion has this sort of negative connotation a little bit, where it feels rigid, it feels structured, it feels like this is not based on data, but more just kind of anecdotal personal experience. When young people think about religion, I think they think about rules. And when they think about spirituality, they think about philosophy or purpose or meaning or things that aren't as rigid and are a little bit more freeing. Millennials, both young and old, regardless of if they were born in the 80s or 90s, feel less spiritual peace and well-being than any other generation. So what's interesting is they care about spirituality. They don't really care about religion, but they feel less spiritual peace than any generation that came before them. About 50% of millennials feel at peace spiritually, whereas 62% of boomers feel at peace spiritually. So they don't feel comfortable, which is really fascinating, because you have to wonder, is the disconnect between spirituality and religion causing that discomfort? Some may say that is the case. I think that may be true. But I think it's important as we try to reach young people, millennials or Gen Z, those who follow, because honestly, like there's no data on this yet, because Gen Z is still pretty young to be surveying in high capacities like millennials are, because you can't survey people until they're 18. But I think this is going to be only more true about Gen Z, the generation following millennials, the generation that's in your youth groups and children's ministries right now. Mm-hmm. I think it's important, whether you're a pastor, a church leader, a parent, parenting a millennial, though most of them are, getting out of college now, hopefully starting to move out. Pastors and church leaders or whomever, it's important to remember that as you try to reach unbelieving millennials, that there's about a 50-50 chance that the people you're speaking to don't feel at peace with where they are spiritually, which is a good thing when it comes to sharing the gospel with people, because that means that they're like, I feel like I'm not really comfortable. I'm not really sure that what I think about spiritual things is right, which is an encouraging thing when you're trying to share the gospel. It would be more discouraging if everyone was – If young people were saying, I'm really comfortable with the fact that I don't believe in any real God or spiritual or religious system.
Good point.
But I think it's good too to recognize that young people, specifically millennials, have a deep sense of wonder about the universe at a higher rate than older generations. So about 50% of millennials say that they have a, quote, deep sense of wonder about the universe, and the percentages are lower for generations that are older than them. So that they're open to something beyond. There's this idea, I think, because I've heard it in so many evangelism conversations, that in order to win people to Christ, you have to get them past just thinking we're hunks of flesh that have no purpose beyond what we can measure in science. And for reaching older generations, that may be true. But we don't see among millennials a significantly high percentage of people who are just naturalists, who just think whatever we can measure in science is real. That sentiment certainly does exist, but this data shows us that a large portion of millennials feel as though there's some sort of deeper meaning beyond what we can just measure through science and otherwise. Mm-hmm.
Chris, thank you so much for coming on the show. I love your insight. You do great thinking and great presenting. So have a great Memorial weekend, and I'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, you too.
Yep. 3 minutes till the top of the hour. We'll wrap up the show in just a minute. If you are one of 42 million traveling this weekend, please be safe. And if you're just sticking around this weekend, have a very blessed weekend. And I will see you next Tuesday. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.